Welcome to the conference. Please enter the conference ID followed by the pound key. Thank you. Guest ID accepted.
Hey, good evening, everyone. Welcome to another Tuesday night installment here at Your Remedies in the Law. Tonight, of course, we're discussing various IRS administrative remedies with our speaker, Mr. Tony Davis. My name is Mark Michaels. I'll be your host for this evening's conference brought to you by Your Remedies in the Law, which is in direct affiliation with Americans Restoring America. Before we get started with this evening, though, it is very important that I provide you with the following disclaimer.
Nothing that you hear on this call tonight may be deemed by you in any way, shape, or form to be legal advice. If you are on this call because of a situation in your life where you require legal advice, I very politely ask you to hang up the phone. Now, we don't mean to sound rude when we say this. We just want to express to everyone in no uncertain terms that anyone joining this call looking for legal advice has no place or business here. Nobody here at Your Remedies in the Law or any of the programs offered by Americans Restoring America is a lawyer, attorney, or any member of the bar. Therefore, no one here is able to offer you any legal advice. If you require legal advice, my advice to you would be get an attorney. As for these calls, they're all just for entertainment purposes. It's just folks saying what they might do where they're similarly situated to you. You might get a little bit of education out of it, but mainly you're just going to get folks' opinions about what they might do. However educated and experienced these thoughts and opinions might be, they are just people's opinions nonetheless, and it's always up to you to do your own due diligence. All right, on to the next subject. I'd like to go over a few things here with Your Remedies in the Law, if I could, very quickly. First of all, if I can take everybody to the homepage of www.yourremediesinthelaw.com, if we look up in the upper right-hand corner, we see a little picture of the Constitution. Click on that, and you'll have a separate page come up with just two items on it. These two items are of much importance, though, especially if this is all new to you. First and most importantly on the left is the jurisdictionary course. This is your 24-hour crash course on the rules of civil procedure. Better known to some as American jurisprudence or ANJUR, the rules of civil procedure are essentially the foundation or structure upon which all law in America rests. So to have a firm and thorough understanding of these rules means to have at least a basic understanding of what's going on in virtually any court scenario that you find yourself in. On the right is the common law default process, mostly known for its high national win rate in most traffic cases throughout the country. At least that's what it's most popularly acquired for. But that is not really why it's on this page. The reason that we have it up here with the jurisdictionary course is when you go through it, you'll notice that it utilizes a lot of the same fundamental procedures that you learned about in the jurisdictionary course. So it kind of acts as a real-life homework assignment. Also, for a lot of folks, it's their first time committing to action. Folks seem a little more willing to take that first step, probably because of such a high success rate and traffic scenarios being such a common interest in this country today. The common law default, although known majorly for traffic purposes, has many other. Truly, it's for most scenarios that you may find yourself in where there's no damage to property or person. It's just some entity is claiming you broke a rule, therefore you must pay a civil penalty. Both of these items are very affordably priced. The jurisdictionary with a contribution of $250 and the common law default at $150. Also on the subject of Your Remedies in the Law, most of you are probably familiar now with Americans Restoring America. Every time you visit the homepage of yourremediesinthelaw.com, you are met with that blue box that pops up asking if you'd like to continue on to the site that you were visiting or stay and visit Americans Restoring America. The reason that we've done this is very simple. We're trying to get folks to explore. There are multiple information providers talking about multiple subjects, as well as many other features and study groups at Your Remedies in the Law. And Your Remedies in the Law is just one of a couple dozen websites that all together make up Americans Restoring America. So there's quite a bit for you to see, and we hope that you'll do just that at your leisure. If you have any questions about whether or not we have an information provider that could give you their personal educated opinion about your particular situation, get a hold of us at yourremediesinthelaw.com, and we'll be happy to assist you in any way that we can. Statewide communications. If you're not already a member, please do sign up. Tell your friends and family about it. That's that map of the United States that you see on virtually every site that we have. It's a private communications platform that enables folks to speak with one another on a local level based on a very strict pre-decided topics of discussion. Essentially, how it works is this. A wizard will walk you through a very easy setup. You know, put your name in here, click next. Put your zip code in here, click next, that sort of thing. Then it will walk you through the remainder of the setup. And then you get to a point where it will ask you what are your hot points interested in. This could range anything from credit card issues, home foreclosure, IRS matters, asset protection, or maybe veterans' rights, maybe personal health rights, anything that you can think of. If it affects your personal rights, you should find it in that list or something that's close enough. When the setup is complete, it puts it all together, much of what you think of a social network. Though nothing like a social network. It's very custom. It's very private. But it then puts you in contact with people in your local area that have similar interests to you. The idea here is to put the power of education and communication back in the hands of the common man. If you are in need of legal advice or you need someone to represent you, you're going to have to get an attorney. It's just that simple. But if there was a way, a private place that you could go to discuss matters, your personal opinions, their personal opinions, with people that were like-minded, maybe you jump online one day and you say, this happened to me today. First person comes back and says, well, I disagree with that. I don't think that they should be able to do that. I don't think that's fair. Well, that's probably not going to be of a tremendous amount of help to you. Maybe the next person comes on and says, well, I'll tell you what I would do were I similarly situated. I'd watch these YouTube videos, and then I'd go down there to my local county courthouse, go to the law library, get a law dictionary, and look at these terms. Maybe the next person after that says, those all sound like great ideas. I'd also go to this particular website and check out these educational materials that might assist you in your learning. And then for you to go and do some due diligence on what you're reading, just people's suggestions, people's opinions at all. But if you did some due diligence and educated yourself, maybe the farther you got into it, you discovered that it's not as difficult as you initially thought it would be because you're focused on one single subject. And you get to a point where you've educated yourself, and now you're handling your own affairs, your own matters. Well, folks, there's nothing illegal or unlawful about that. And that's all we're trying to do here at Statewide Communications is just very simply get people to start talking again. Of course, there's no cost to you for using Statewide Communications, either signing up or the regular using of it. And so we hope that you'll pass that around. Freedom is radio. If you're over the road, you don't want to deal with the call process, and you're new to your remedies in the law, and you don't yet have your username and password, therefore you can't see the phone number and the PIN. By the way, if you'd like to pick up a membership to your remedies in the law, it's very easy. You just simply click the register button. Fill out your basic information there. You'll enjoy the first 30 days for free to evaluate it. After that, it converts to a very affordable $10 a month on your credit card or your PayPal. And every single call is recorded. You have years of archives to go through, a vast wealth of knowledge, as well as many other wonderful features. But if that's not an option for you today, you have freedomsradio.com. Every night, the calls go out over the air at 9 p.m. Eastern live. There's also a question bar there where you can type in a question, click submit. As long as that's during call hours, that will pop up on the moderator screen, and we do our best to read every single one of those questions out over the air as long as they are appropriate. So you'll get them one-on-one with the information provider like you would be by being a private member, but you do get your questions answered. There's no cost to utilize Freedom's Radio, so no matter where you are or your circumstances, you never have to miss a call again if you don't wish. All right, winding down here, I'd like to go over one last bit of housekeeping. This is your caveat emptor, or your buyer beware. For any purchase that you may make at your remedies in the law or any of the other sites underneath the umbrella of Americans Restoring America, when you come aboard and you go with an information provider, you are doing just that. Information providers pay Mr. Edward for advertising at your remedies in the law. This payment would be an expense to that information provider along with any other expenses that they might have associated with your particular product or service. When you contact us, all we simply do is listen to your particular scenario, quickly deduce from a list of folks that honestly most of you would probably never be able to find on your own just simply because they can't be found. And we make those introductions. Not every part on the information provider is always going to be successful. Everybody always hopes for the best. We plan for the best, and believe you me, we aim for the best. But unavoidable things do sometimes happen, and when they do, you have to roll with them and deal with them as you would with anything else in life. But we also want to emphasize, though, that the intent is always to be successful. If you have any questions of that, we welcome you to visit www.yourremedyisinthelaw.com/testimonials and see what others have to say about these products and services. Now, let's touch very quickly on the subject of refunds or the refund policy. There is none. Not if the remedy is in the law, anyway. Of course, when you call board and you go with a particular information provider, again, that is exactly what you're doing. So any discussion of a refund or a credit would be a strict and private matter between you and the information provider, and even then, that's very few and far between. It must be extenuating circumstances. You are expected to have done your due diligence before you commit to any particular process or information provider's time. All right, lastly, pertaining here to all of the information providers at Your Remedies in the Law, we'd like you to remind everybody that all of our speakers at these conferences are our guests and should be treated with the highest level of respect. If you disagree with something that a speaker has to say, that's fine. Disagreeing is how we learn, but please, you must always be civil. Besides, if a question is posed properly and then answered properly, then we can all learn something from it.
All right, Martin, thank you so very much for this disclaimer. I appreciate it. Ladies and gentlemen, we go through this disclaimer on every single call. And the reason for it is because it's critical. I have been marketing what I term information providers for nearly 30 years now. And as I've watched others who do what I do, sometimes they get indicted and they have a trial and then they go to jail for practicing law without a license, even though the very definition of practicing law without a license has to do with barred attorneys and nobody else. But that's, don't let the facts get in the way of a good story. Anyways, so we do this disclaimer, and there is just absolutely no way that anyone can misunderstand that if you are here for legal advice or financial advice, please just hang up and go contact a lawyer, because that's what they get paid to do, is to give you their advice. All right, tonight, before I get started, I want to say that we have a special speaker tonight for a very, very short bit. He asked for about 5 minutes to make an announcement, and we'll do that at the top of the hour, so in about 5 minutes, something like that. And at that time, Alan, press *2 on your keypad so that I make certain that I take care of you first. I don't want to forget that. And also joining us this evening is a long time ago friend, an associate, Craig, out in California. I want to thank Craig. We stumbled across each other tonight when he joined, Telegram or one of the other social medias. And he said my name was the first one that popped up. And, of course, as soon as he came on, I popped up, too. He popped up for me, so I went and reached out to him. It's good. So maybe we'll hear from him for a few minutes tonight, too, before we get into Q&A, just for a quick update. PJ's here. Good. Thank you, Guy. So let's do a little groundwork here before we turn the call over to PJ. Only in the United States are we the people, the sovereignty, which we govern by way of our constitutional republic. At no other time in all the world's history has there ever been the case where the people held the power. All other nations have different forms of government. They might be monarchies, they might be dictatorships, they might be oligarchies, and several other forms. But regardless, only historically and current through today has there ever been a nation that existed where the people enjoyed co-sharing in the sovereignty. And that's critical, because that is what is unique about America. That is what is unique above all other things, and that's what we have to fight to preserve. Don't ever let any organization convince you that we need to have a new constitutional convention in order to make things better than what they were when they were set up 240-plus years ago. No. What we need to do is to get rid of the scumbags that hold office and that use office for their own political power and not there to be our servants. So our servants, those in the government, have been successful subverting our Constitution and form of government, starting with the 14th Amendment of 1868, followed by the Act of 1871. Then they moved into the Social Security Act of 1935 and the Buck Act of 1940. Let's not, of course, forget the 1913 Federal Reserve Act. Through our own ignorance and mass, we've lost the understandings that our founding fathers had and employed. Tonight on this call, you're going to learn how to defend against this fraud perpetuated by our government, or rather, I should say, the people that you can hire to teach you how to navigate this. With no constitutional authority whatsoever, the Congress created a separate form of government for a little bitty piece of land, and that was found in the District of Columbia, a 10-mile square parcel of land. Reference the Acts of the 41st Congress, Section 34, Section 3, Chapter 61 and 62. The Act, passed when the country was weakened and financially depleted in the aftermath of the Civil War, was a strategic move by foreign interests, international bankers, or banksters as I like to call them, who were intent upon gaining a stranglehold on the financial coffers of our nation and the very neck of America. Congress cut a deal with these international banksters, specifically the Rothschilds of London, to incur debt to said bankers, because the bankers were not about to lend money to a floundering nation without some serious stipulations. They devised a way to get their foot into the door of the United States of America. The Act of 1871 formed a corporation called, all of an uppercase, the United States. The corporation was owned by foreign interests. They moved in and effectively shoved our original Constitution into the back out of everybody's sight and mind, and without even anybody realizing that a great switch took place. With the Act of 1871, the organic Constitution was defaced, in effect vandalized and sabotaged, when the title was moved into an all-capitalized expression and the word for, a Constitution for the United States, was changed to of the United States. So let's go into that real quick. When you did, when the, we the people, we created our Constitution, we created it for our public servants to operate through. And that showed and demonstrated that we the people were in charge and we were doing something for ourselves through the United States. But when we changed it to the Constitution of the United States, then the United States is the possessor and owner of the Constitution, not we the people. So the flip was made right there. And we people, not being legalese in terms and thinking in the way we talk, we didn't really pay any attention to the fact that everything was in uppercase and that the words had been changed. The Constitution of the United States of America, all uppercase, is the Constitution of the incorporated United States of America. It operates in an economic capacity and has been used to fool we the people and to unknowingly become the indentured and indebted servants to this new corporation, the United States, and that it governs the Republic. That's what they've convinced us of. It does not. The capitalization of the United States is not insignificant when one is referring to legal documents. The seemingly minor alteration had a major impact on every subsequent generation of Americans since. So is there a difference between being an American national or a United States national and a U.S. citizen, in your opinion? Well, you won't like this. I'm going to quote the law, and the law really isn't interested in what you think or what you fantasize or what you feel good about. The law is raw and naked and powerful, and the law is what the law is. So let's go into this just a little bit. I'm going to quote some cases, and then I'm going to turn the call over to PJ to do his monologue, and then we'll open it up with, and then we'll give a little introduction to a few other speakers real quick, just give them a moment, and then we'll go into Q&A. Remember also, everybody, that the call that we do on Tuesday night is to rub your nose into what the law says so that you understand that there is a solution, which you find out on Monday night, and that's simply correcting your status. And we'll get into that more deeply on Monday. But anyways, and also what you need to understand is that what you hear from PJ is basically the spokesman for something I call the team. And the team is several individuals who are, as Jefferson said, knowledgeable in the law and well-disposed to using it. These people, some of them have their Juris Doctorate, even. A couple of them do. Some of them are trading as paralegals. The states require them to be certified as a paralegal. Other states like Florida, there's no requirement. If you know the law and, you're working for an attorney, they call you a paralegal. There you go. And then there's others still that have never gone to law school and have, you know, come into this by their bootstraps, and you know, they don't want you in their court, these people. So it's a great team that we've put together, and we're constantly looking to expand it. Anyways, we'll cover that on another time. So let's talk about some cases here. In Maxwell versus Dow, this is a 20 SCR 448 at page 455, when we read, quote, the privileges, it didn't say the rights now, it said the privileges and immunities of citizens of the United States do not necessarily include all the rights protected by the first eight amendments of the federal Constitution against the powers of the federal government, end quote. Now, that's got to be a burr in your saddle. It's telling you right there that there's two groups of citizenship, and that one has privileges and immunities, and it doesn't. And then it says that they don't necessarily enjoy the rights protected by the first eight amendments. That's going to be very telling. In U.S. versus Valentine, 288 F sub 957, we read, the only, now that's singular, okay? And also, you know, the Congress lies. I'm sure that comes as a total surprise to you, but they'll use the word rights when they really should have been using the word privileges, because they're distinctly different. But it says here, the only absolute and qualified right of a United States citizen is to residence, quote, within the territorial boundaries of the United States. Okay? United States citizens have only one right, and that is for residence, that's a legal term, within the territorial boundaries of the United States. Look, if you're in Nebraska, isn't that one of the several states? It is. If you're in Georgia, isn't that one of the several states? Yeah. California? Sure. But the state of Nebraska is a territory of the United States, the Buck Act, 1940. The state of Georgia, the state of California, those are all territories. And if you don't know, and you sit there and say, yeah, I'm in the state of California, you just admitted that you're in a territory. Wheeling Steel Corporation versus Fox, 298 U.S. 193, blah, 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 draws the conclusion, quote, therefore, the U.S. citizen, open bracket, citizens of the District of Columbia, close bracket, residing in one of the states of the Union, are classified as property and franchises of the federal government as an individual entity. I thought the 13th Amendment got rid of slavery. But you know what? It did. It got rid of involuntary slavery. You can volunteer to be a slave. Did you know that? Well, we'll find out another case or two when we get here in a minute. Hendricks versus Maryland, SC Reporters, 1914, furthers, quote, a U.S. citizen upon leaving the District of Columbia becomes involved in interstate commerce as a resident and does not have the common law rights, blah, 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 of a citizen of one of the several states. And the way it actually reads, it says does not have the common law right to travel. But you can get rid of to travel and just put any right you want in there, because a U.S. citizen doesn't have rights from the creator of the universe. A U.S. citizen has privileges that they call rights from the Congress. American Banana Company versus United Fruit Company. This is 1909, 213 U.S. 347. Quote, construction of any statute as intended to be confined in its operation and effect to the territorial limits over which the lawmaker has general and legitimate power. It's telling you right there that their power is in the territorial lands of territorial people. So what maybe we conclude from all this? Well, we can conclude that a United States citizen is a corporation all by themselves. In an ex parte of Frank Knowles, quote, it might be said that there's no such thing as a citizen of the United States. A citizen of one of the states of the Union is held to be and called a citizen of the United States, although technically and abstractly there is no such thing. This can be confirmed in the definitions of Title 5 USC, Title 26 USC, and Title 1 of the United States Code. Therefore, a citizen is actually a piece of property. And as long as you maintain the fact that you are a federal citizen, Your birth certificate was handed off to Vital Statistics in your state. Vital Statistics forwarded to the State Department of the United States, where they classified you as a federal citizen. Didn't ask anybody. They just dropped you in there. And then they forwarded your birth certificate on to the International Monetary Fund, where they monetized your birth certificate. So right now, everyone on this call, unless you have corrected your status, the one thing that gives you incredible leverage, a fulcrum against any weight of the government, unless you get this done, you're just property, and they can do whatever they want with you. So a couple more statements here, court cases, then we'll go over to PJ here. 14th Amendment defines what a U.S. citizen is. Section 1, all persons born or naturalized in the United States. Remember the definition, United States is just that little piece of land over there near Maryland and Virginia, 10 miles within the seat of power. And it criminally converts U.S. citizenship completely upside down from what the Founding Fathers intended. City of Dallas versus Mitchell. The rights of the individuals are restricted only to the extent that they've been voluntarily surrendered by the citizenship to the agencies of government. Well, that's another two-hour conversation. Wadley versus Newell, 1905. Civil rights under the 14th Amendment are for federal citizens and not state citizens. Federal citizens as parents have no right to the custody of their infant children except subject to the paramount right of the state. What can say more about ownership than that? The United States owns you. Anyways, we've said enough. So let's go ahead and let me close this out. I'm going to turn the call over to PJ. Hey, Michael, I saw your hand raised. I'm going to be bringing on I've lost my place here. Anyways, there'll be a few others before you, and then we'll get to you. PJ, how's it going, buddy?
Pretty good. Are you going to bring Alan on here pretty soon?
Well, I was going to bring Alan on after you gave your conversation. Do you want me to let Alan talk right now? He's got something that's very important to say.
Yeah.
I did a little research after we talked. You want?
That'd be fine.
Okay.
That might inspire some of our conversation.
Yes, it might. It just might. Alan, press star 2, will you please? I don't see you here. There you are, hiding. Okay, Alan. Tell us and show us how our friends and great conservators of our freedoms are generously offering to make pot legal, and what is the underbelly of it all?
Well, for the viewers listening, if they could get a paper and pencil, I've got a phone call or a phone number that they can call, which will be very beneficial to them if they decide to notify their representative and their congressman. As of tomorrow, the decriminalization of marijuana, they call it the Moore Act, it's bill number HR 3617, is coming up for discussion. It will be voted upon in Friday of this week. The bill has passed the House once before in December of 2019. But being it ran out with the new Congress, and it had to be voted on again. And it will be as on Friday. You can call your congressman or your representative and express your view on how you would like him to vote. And remind him he is a servant of the people. He is not the Lord in God the way he votes. It's the way you want him to vote. It's very helpful to remind his representatives to tell him of this on your phone call. The phone number for Washington information is 202-224-3121. I will repeat that again. The phone number is 202-224-3121. You will get an operator, and at that time, you request the senator or the representative's phone number from your state. If you do not know the representative or the senator from your state, they will inform you of who it is, and at that time, they will give you their phone number. And you can express your opinion to them, which would greatly be appreciated by me, as to how you would like them to vote. This bill was brought up by a Congressman Daryl Nadler and a David Scott of Georgia. Nadler is of New York. I've known both gentlemen, and they are fairly reputable. Of course, they are politicians, and that's to say the least. But with the passage, if this bill passes, it has great repercussions throughout the entire country, both medically, legally, and recreationally. And there is more to this bill than just the decriminalization of marijuana. It has great repercussions, favorable repercussions on the whole country, in my estimation.
All right, Alan. I'm not old enough to personally remember Prohibition. I did study it, and there was something that was unique that came out about Prohibition that I'd like you to share with the listeners, and then tell them that Prohibition was one thing, the way it was worded, or show them how it was, what was in the wording that was unique, and how this present bill is using the nation's desire for legalization of marijuana to do something else. Can you cover that?
Well, it's not really meant to do something else. Let's just say a lot of, matter of fact, I've brought to the attention of Mr. Nadler and Mr. Scott what the bill was called, the Volstead Act. Now, there's not too many people living in this day and age that remember or know of the Volstead Act, but that was a repeal of the alcohol law. Prohibition. It was illegal to own, drink, or even be around alcohol, but the Volstead Act repealed that law in May of 1930. And then part of that law, it stated that every statute passed or law that comes into existence must be in succession. That means the bills must be in 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5 order. Now, when this LURE Act comes into law, if and hopefully it does, it more or less throws everything out of kilter with the U.S. justice system, because it will totally destroy Title 18 and Title 20, which were enacted in 1948 and 1921, because it will take them out of succession. So there's more to this law than actually meets the eye, but the major part of it is that we get marijuana or cannabis legalized, and then we can take apart the justice system. But until then, that's not going to be an option unless the MORE Act gets passed.
And, so, what is the language that you'll be using when you contact these representatives? Your representatives. What will you say to them?
I don't want to put the wording in people's mouths. No, I am in favor
of
the
asking,
bill.
No, what would you say to your representative?
What
in
I
favor
would
of the
say,
bill?
Or what I have said to my representative, which is Gallagher, he's in the House of Representatives, he's a scumbag, that I reminded him that he is a servant of the people and not a lord or god or king to vote upon any bill that he wants to vote on his way. He is to be reminded that he is a servant and he is to vote the way the people want him to vote, not the way he wants to. And I told him I was in favor of this bill because it has great advantages for the entire nation and the people in it. And that's how I would address it. I encourage people to call their representatives at this time because it's in the House of Representatives and it will be voted upon. And once it's voted upon in the House of Representatives, then it goes to the Congress or the Senate. And at that time, I encourage people to contact their congressman and express their views on which way they want them to vote, not the way they want to vote, but the way the people want them to vote. And that's the way I would do it, or have done it.
Super.
Because I've been in contact with several of the representatives from the House of Representatives, and it seems fairly favorable at this point. But we need the people of this nation to join together and fight for something that's going to benefit them. That's my point of view. I thank you for your time.
And thank you for sharing that with us, Alan. We appreciate that. At this time, since we've got just a few minutes before PJ will come back, I just want to say hello to Craig. I'm going to unmute your phone, Craig. Craig, say hello to everyone. Craig, you there? Is your phone muted, Craig? Oh, lost him. Don't know what happened. Anyways, Craig goes back to the old days with me. Back in the days when we were marketing David Merlin. And if you remember, David Merlin is the one that taught us about what his phrase was, quote, offensive litigating strategies, end quote. And Craig was a super guy at the team, on the team at that time. I'm sorry, he dropped off the call somehow, I guess. Anyways, so let's go back to PJ. And thank you, PJ, for your patience. I appreciate that. So share with us how the team, you and the team, work together to exploit the weaknesses, the underbelly, if you would, of the beast.
Yeah, it's interesting. In the civil, not the Civil War, the Revolutionary War, way back in 1776, they estimated that when that thing started, the talk about doing something about the British on the country, that only 5% of the people were for opposing the British. Only 5%. So those 5% were able to convince the majority of the remainder that they had enough power to do something. Otherwise, nobody thought they even had a chance to prevail. And that's a lot. That's pretty much what we got going on now, is that you take the average American that's paying federal taxes and you explain to him that he has no, there's no evidence that he has a legal duty to file or pay. And even if he does have a legal duty to file or pay, he can require the government to produce that evidence. He doesn't have to file or pay, and he can force them to create the assessment and tell him how much he is required to pay under penalties of perjury by them. But the average American is scared. He's just too scared to do anything about it. I remember going to churches, and I'm one of the leading individuals in America on the topic of the scope of Title 26, and not one person in my old church, which is a wonderful church, about 100 people, not one person came to me and asked me to explain what I understood about the legal scope of Title 26. Not one. And it's just so disappointing. I thought for sure that 20% would come. Not even one. So what I realized is that they actually do believe that they're comfortable with those chains on them. They're making good money, and they got peace with the wife. And but I'm one of those people that I don't care how much money I make, and I don't care really what my wife would say if I was married. That's probably why I'm not married. But anyway, nobody's going to tell me not to do the right thing. Nobody. We are commanded by God to do the right thing and not even ask about the consequences. Don't even ask about the consequences. God will take care of that. If you're killed for doing the right thing, glory to God. If you have complete success and come out of it unscathed, glory to God. Either way. So that's a lot what we're looking at here. We've got just this 0.5% maybe of people that are actually willing to stand up for in a big way. Maybe it's less than that to go against some of the encroachment of the federal government. When you travel the country, you'll see like for example Nebraska. I was raised in Nebraska. You know, there's two federal courthouses in Nebraska, one on the east side, one on the west side, and those federal courthouses are for federal persons. They're not for the free inhabitant or the American national. It's not for them. They're not for man. They're for federal persons and activity that occurs in federal zones. That's what those courts are for. And the United States courts that are associated with the same jurisdiction of those courts, that's what those courts are for. The other court's jurisdiction of the land is American common law, which they've completely, because of their organization and the Bar Association, they've completely hid the Seventh Amendment from the American people, is probably a good way to say it. A lot of people, I mean, how many times have you heard the Seventh Amendment quoted in your life on national media? I don't think I ever have. Never. Maybe I have, but I don't remember it. I mean, you'll hear the Fourth Amendment, First Amendment, Second Amendment, Third Amendment, Fourth, but you just don't hear the Seventh Amendment. And the Seventh Amendment is, you know, your right to the common law courts. And it's a right. It's not a privilege. It's not a service provided by the United States. It's the right of the people. And essentially, a Seventh Amendment court, a common law court, is just your ability to go to the people of your community and ask them to adjudicate biblically various matters that people bring to them. That's just as simple as you can get it. So, and that's a big part of what we do. We have, for example, IRS cases where we are presenting to the administrator, the United States Court's judge, because they basically kidnap individuals and arrest them and bring them in and prosecute them. And we're forcing that administrator, that what they call a U.S. federal judge, to turn to the prosecutor, the United States prosecutor, and force the prosecutor to bring in the evidence that our student is a person that's required to file and has a requirement to pay a specific amount of money. And it's such a simple request, and they run from it. And they refuse to answer those questions. And sometimes they just simply say everybody's required to pay taxes. And most people say, oh, okay, how can I argue against that? And they don't even think about saying, Well, then put most people on the witness stand so I can cross-examine them. If that's your evidence, I have a right to cross-examine that evidence. Put them on the witness stand. Put most of the people on the witness stand now. Otherwise, hold your peace about any using that as evidence against me. And you turn to the judge and explain to him that 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 they're not producing any evidence that you're required to file or pay. That's just an example of a big example of the simplicity that you need to maintain in a U.S. court. You must keep the burden of proof on them. Anything less, and you're likely going to lose your case. It's difficult to win a case, even when you keep the burden of proof on them, for especially for novice. We've never lost an IRS case. Been doing this for 30 years, I think. And probably close to the people I work with is probably 200 cases. And virtually all of them have been sealed. Or they just walk away from the case and they choose not to prosecute. It's pretty exciting. Very few people want to even bother talking to us about going against the IRS and challenging the IRS to produce. If you go to the IRS and ask them, before you do anything, you start sending letters to them and ask them, you know, am I required to file a 1040 tax form? Am I required to file any form into the United States system through the IRS collection agency? And they have a legal duty to answer your questions. Now, what we're doing is we're getting evidence of asking those questions. You can videotape them, you can audio tape them, record them. You can get proof of mailings. You can get witnesses to prove what you mailed. All that is very important in getting the IRS to back off almost immediately, or the United States to back off. The IRS isn't prosecuting you. The United States prosecutors are. IRS just comes in as a witness to testify as a collection agency. And the number one thing the IRS agent doesn't want to do is get into the witness stand and commit perjury. If you're a man that has no liability to pay or fill out a tax form, the IRS agent, in my experience, will never testify ever that you do have a requirement to fill out one of those forms or pay a specific amount. I've never seen it ever happen. They get in the witness stand and they testify, oh, everybody's required to pay. They will not just actually, they'll present documents that other people have assembled, and most of them are not even signed. The prosecutor put those into evidence, but it's not the IRS agent that's on the witness stand that assembled those documents. They make sure that they have enough distance from the evidence that's going in so they don't end up losing their house for committing perjury on the witness stand. Now, as far as the other areas that the government reaches out and touches you, property taxes is probably the second thing. You got federal and state taxes. They're the same thing. If you owe a federal tax, you owe a state tax. If you don't owe a federal tax, you don't owe a state tax. Then the next thing that generally touches us in a big way is property taxes. Property taxes are a state requirement. Michael talked about the state of Iowa, state of Texas, state of Nebraska. If your land is in the state of anything, it's taxable. But only less than 25% of American soil is in the state of anything. Very likely your land is not in the state of anything, and therefore it's not taxable as a matter of law. You're being deceived into paying property taxes. You can go through a process and challenge the property taxes, which we've done many times, and had tremendous success. So that's exciting to look forward to, because property taxes, one of the number one ways the government uses to control
the minds of the people. They control the children from kindergarten all the way through grad school with property taxes predominantly. And they pretty much brainwash them and make good little citizens out of them to where they don't even ask. They won't even come to one of the leading experts in the nation to simply talk to them or go to one of their presentations or even go to a website and take an hour to read something to see if what the definition of freedom is in America. The freedom in China and freedom in the Soviet Union, for example, and maybe even Russia now, is a whole lot different than the freedoms that are guaranteed to us in the Constitution, the four constitutions that are a part of the founding, all the way from the founding fathers to the present day. So that's what we do. That's the group of. Go ahead.
Let's focus on litigation for a moment. There's two types of litigation or positions to litigate from. One is when you're dealing with property and the property is held by, in a trust, and someone like PJ or one of the other team members can be applied with, quote, limited powers of attorney, end quote, to actually defend and communicate with the court system on your behalf. Not on your behalf, but on behalf of the trust. And then the other is where you are having to be placed in a position where you're a student and a member of the team is the teacher, and they walk you through the entire process. They provide you with teaching material that might be something similar to what filed in your instant matter as it applies properly and things like that. So there's just a complete and total system in place. The one change that we've made, though, in the last 30 days is that we are not going to take on any more new students without that student first having corrected their status. That is such an incredibly powerful fulcrum with which to leverage against the people that are coming against you, and it's incredible. So do you want to talk about that for a second, the types of litigation that you're doing, and maybe share a case or two without naming names of something recent?
For example, we were talking about IRS cases. I'll just talk. Yeah, we got so many cases going on. We got marriage cases where the wife went berserk and is trying to take everything away from individuals, and she's relying on the state to basically steal from her husband everything he's ever worked for in all his life because she's a woman, and they just rape the man and he's left with nothing. But we go in and challenge if the U.S. courts have jurisdiction to administer the property of that family. And when we start out doing it, the judges look at us like, what are you talking about? Well, Your Honor, state marriage licenses are for state persons. Is that correct? Yeah, and state marriage licenses are similar to a fishing license. A state fishing license operates in land that, which is the same as saying in water, area. It's an area where the state has jurisdiction to license. And the judge goes, yeah. Well, what evidence do you have that the defendant is a state person, or does any activity at all in the state, or was in the state when the so-called this marriage license was activated. If he wasn't in the state, he was fraudulently giving a marriage license. It's similar, and we explain it to the judge. It's similar to he comes in, Bill comes in, he says, I want to fish in that lake over there. See it across the road there? And the state agent says, well, you're going to need a state fishing license. Okay, well, I want to fish, so how much is it? And $35. So he pays the $35. And the truth is, the state doesn't own that lake. So he just lied to that individual to get $35. And the marriage license is the same way. they go in there and they're anxious to get married, and they wonder, they want to keep the wife happy and the and all the family members happy, so they run in and get a marriage license, and they don't even live on government land, or and also they're not a U.S. person. They've never done any elected to become a United States citizen, which is an election. It's not by birth. It's never by birth. And they lie to the people. They take, they line them up. They take their marriage licenses one after another, and then they utilize that as a false claim against administrating their lives thereafter and their children thereafter. So as far as correcting your status or getting the proper evidence and the record in the United States system as to your status, right now when they bring up your records, they're looking at a birth certificate, they're looking at a Social Security number, they're looking at a zip code, they're looking at an address in the United States, they're looking at residing in the city or county or state of the United States, and all that is fraudulently communicated. All of it is. So what we are doing is we are going in and we're communicating to them to prove that you're a U.S. person, that you're administratable under the United States system. And we're forcing them to give us a document that there's no evidence that you're an administratable person by the United States system. So if you're not administratable, go ahead.
To help make this more understandable, use your favorite search engine and type in these specific words: map of all U.S. federal land. Do it right now if you're in front of your computer. And what you're going to see is the south of Canada, north of Mexico, all the states. You're going to see lines where you have the meets and bounds of each individual state. You'll notice that in California, the entire east side of California is federal land, but the coastline itself and midway through the state belongs to the people. Nevada almost is entirely U.S. government land. Much of Arizona, much of Colorado is U.S. government land. Large portion of New Mexico. Texas, very, very little bit of government land. Iowa has, I don't see any in Iowa whatsoever. Rhode Island, Connecticut. Rhode Island has, I think, like 4% or 1% is government land. So only on the government land, the red part of this map, and again, the map's title is Map of All U.S. Federal Land. That's the only place where federal law applies, and that's even challengeable there, because the premise of our Constitution says that Article 1, Section 8, Clause 17, the government is to give away all land or sell all the land, get rid of it to the people. So that's, if you look at that map and then you understand about jurisdiction, if you're sitting on top of the red, it's questionable. You may be on U.S. land, so you may be having to deal with it. But if you're not on that little red space, you know, Bureau of Land Management will come in and tell you if that's United States federal land you're sitting on. And I'll bet you dollars to donuts it's not. Back to you, PJ, and then we're going to open up for Q&A real quick.
Yeah, the Bureau of Land Management, those people, that, in my experience, they're excited about somebody coming in and asking who owns such lands, because they when they go in and work for them, they realize, like, oh my goodness, the federal government is operating as though they have jurisdiction over all this land, and they only have jurisdiction over 0.4% of it, 1.4% of it, or up to 34% of it. In Nevada, 70 or 84%. So Connecticut is 0.4%, you know, just almost non-existent. But I've been in court where I've challenged a police officer to bring in evidence of that location being in the city of Omaha, for example. And they bring in a document, and I remember one time a guy was in the witness stand and he testified, well, we don't have a map of the city of Omaha.
Okay, so you said it occurred in the city of Omaha. So show me a map of city of Omaha so that I can stay out of the city of Omaha so I don't get harassed by you again. And he goes, well, there is no such thing. And I told him, I said, well, everybody knows that when you drive in through the main roads, there's a big sign out there that says, welcome to the city of Omaha. Or welcome to the state of Nebraska. It's similar to it. And he says, well, there's no city map. There's no such thing. I said, so you asked the prosecutor to get you one? He said, yeah, there's no such thing. He says, what he did get me is a map of the county. And I said, he reads it off, the boundaries of the county. He thought, oh, I got you now. I got TJ now. So he reads off the boundaries of the county, and then I simply ask the judge, Your Honor, he says it's the boundaries of the county. Is that the same county that's defined in the statutes at large, which is synonymous with a possession or territory of the United States? Or is he referring to some other, you know, just a generic common law county that people just use not in law? And they didn't want to talk about that because they right. knew that it's not going to identify any federal any lands where that U.S. court has jurisdiction. So it's very extremely interesting what goes on in those courts.
Exactly.
And you have to keep the burden of proof on them, and you can actually prevail because the U.S. court, the judge, if you do it properly, he doesn't want to lose his house over this thing. So you'll be very careful about that. Go ahead, Michael. Anything else?
We're gonna bring Craig now forward. He was, I don't know how it happened, but somehow he got thrown off, and now he's back. So I want to introduce everyone to Craig. Welcome, Craig. You're muted. Don't hang up on me.
Can you hear me now? Can you hear me?
Hey, listen.
Can you hear me now, Michael?
Here at Verizon, we're looking for a replacement for the. Can you say that repeatedly? All right, can you hear me now? All right, Craig and I go back a decade plus back in the days of David Marlin when I was marketing David. David was the only arrow in my quiver at that time, and Craig
actually, Michael, it was. The first time I met you was with Richard Cornforth in a San Francisco seminar.
That's right. That's when we met. That was before David Merlin.
Exactly.
Right. I forgot. Wow. That's going back. Anyways, so tell us, you were a student then of other people. Now I understand that you've pretty much gone guru on your own. So tell us what's going on.
Well, I think probably most people are aware now of the court bonding situation. And one of the things that I'm doing now is I have access to a guy that can audit your case number and show that they have created a security and stolen your identity and money laundering. I mean, there's probably, if you look, there's probably 50 different crimes they've committed when they do this stuff. And so what we do is we just notify the court that this is what we're going to talk about, and they notify us that they can't talk about that. And when we get there, they make sure the cops doesn't show up or they dismiss it even beforehand. Because the last time I had this guy who was a total greenhorn, I went to court with him, and the judge calls his name. He walks up to the bar, and the judge puts his hand up like a traffic cop and tells him not to say anything. And he looks around the courtroom and says, the police officer hasn't shown up, so we're going to dismiss these three charges, which were hefty. The fines would have been in excess of $1,000. And so the guy, when we got outside, he was very disappointed he couldn't say anything, because once you find out that they've stolen your identity and that they're, defrauding you at every turn, from cradle to grave, everything that you see a barcode on, they've securitized and monetized for their benefit. not for yours. And once you see that, and you can go into court and say, well, what about this? What the hell's going on here? And actually, what we provide is not evidence yet. What it is information that will lead to evidence. So if they want to open a case, then you get discovery rights, and now you crack the egg open, and you can contact the fund manager and depose the fund manager and find out exactly who's got the Series 7 banker's license that allowed and did this. And actually, if you understand how courts work, they're basically banks. The judges are like the tellers collecting the money, and then the clerks in the background are the ones that are doing all this paperwork. And, of course, they compartmentalize everything, so not one person, unless it's somebody who's been there for 30 years, will know the whole system. And so they think they're doing good work, you know. They think their work is honorable. And, you know, of course, that's the problem with this world is people are thinking and they're not knowing. And that's something I've learned from Merlin is you just stick to facts, law, and evidence, and the rest will take care of itself. And that's what most people don't do. So anyway, we have fun with it. It's funny, today I went on Signal, and I tried to get on Signal, and I was having trouble, and then I was working on this pipe rack I was building, and then I get a beep on my phone, and it says, type this number into your Signal app, and I did that, and then Michael Edward pops up. So that's pretty interesting that happened there.
I'm everywhere, Craig. Hey, tell us about the Committee on Uniform Securities Identification Procedures. What is that, and why is it so unique? What is CUSIP?
Well, CUSIP is basically a numbering system to track security. And they created this stuff, I think it was in the 60s. And it was supposed to be able to track securities and stocks, and so they wouldn't get them confused. Well, what they did was they, of course, as most of the people on this call know, they created all of us into a chattel property. And with that all cap letters name and the Social Security number, they trade us as human chattel. And, I mean, this is like one of the biggest crimes in the history of mankind. Mildenhouse, he was a advisor to Woodrow Wilson. When they came up with this scheme, which was not new, but other countries were doing it. I think they were doing this since like 1607 or 1666, something like that, in like England. But when they did it, started in America, he said, not one in a million people will figure this out. And of course, here we are on the phone, and there's many of us on the phone who figured it out. You know, so so that's the thing. And here's the deal. You don't have to know everything there is to know about CUSIP, you know, Committee on Uniform Procedures Information. You know, all you have to know is that here's my name on a document. It's in this fund. Here's the ticker symbol. The tranche, and then actually what you can do is you can go and you can take, you Google the fund, you Google the ticker symbol, you do some research, and you find out how much your tranche is actually worth in that fund. Because some of these funds, you know, it's like $30 billion are in this fund. We had a guy that was he made up a money order. The IRS said he owed him $500,000, which was preposterous, and so he made up a money order and sent them in. And so, like 12 years later, they come after him and they arrest him with a hit squad, and they say that he tendered a false instrument. Well, when we asked them in court, we said, "So great, he tendered a false instrument. We need to see the instrument." They wouldn't produce it because they securitized it. You know, and so unfortunately we didn't have the number of that security, because otherwise we could have CUSIP. We could have done a CUSIP audit on it and found out exactly what happened. And they knew we were close, but we just weren't close enough. And that's back in the days when that was like 7-8 years ago, And that's in the days when I just didn't know quite enough to do this. You know, the whole thing about us in the movement is we learn a little bit here and a little bit there and a little bit here and a little bit there, and eventually we get it together, you know, because there's not one guy out there that's going to be able to figure all this crap out. You know, you're going to have to talk to many, many people and look at their experience and then incorporate that into yours in order to figure it out. I mean, there's I know lawyers who I talk to, and they're like, they always like talking to me. They don't like me very much because, you know, it's like in California, none of them have licenses. I don't know about the rest of the states, but, and as a matter of fact, I went to the Secretary of State's office, and I asked them, I wanted to see the charter for the California Bar Association, and they said it's been revoked in 1952. Yeah, so it ran out because it was only good for 50 years. And then we, at the same time, we went and we got the incorporation papers of the United States Company Corporation, which was filed in 1922. And, you know, the clerk that we got these from, he says, that's ridiculous. You this is, you know, when we requested it, he said, this is ridiculous. You know, there's no such thing. And then when we went and picked it up 2 weeks later, when they called us and said, yeah, your stuff is here. And he goes, well, I didn't know any of this, you know, because nobody knows anything. You know, they didn't teach us anything in school of any real great value. You know, if they would have taught us, you know, they wanted to teach everybody algebra. How many people on this call use algebra? Probably nobody, you know. But if they would have taught you some basic law, you would have been a lot better off. Anyway.
Yeah, Craig, you mentioned Edward Mendel House. And he was the guy that was working behind the scenes with President Wilson back in 1912, 13, 14, in that area there, times the Federal Reserve action passed. This is his quote. Very soon, every American will be required to register their biological property in a national system designed to keep track of the people, and that will operate under the ancient system of pledging. End quote. There it is. Does that sound familiar? Does that sound like what Fauci and everybody's trying to do today? All right, listen, Greg, it's phenomenal that we had the opportunity to talk today. We've got hands raised, so let me go ahead and put you back on mute. We'll talk again privately, but for right now, we're going to start with Michael in Las Vegas and go to George in Santa Barbara, and while they're talking, I'll go check Freedom's Radio to see if anybody's asked a question there. Go ahead, Michael.
Thank you. I got two things. First of all, me and my brother Pat were born on Indian Reservation in Salamanca, New York. Since most Indian reservations are now sovereign property, do I even fall under, or do we fall under, any federal guidelines?
Did you have a birth certificate?
Yes, I've got that in my hand.
The Center of Vital Statistics in New York. Vital Statistics forwarded it to the State Department of the United States, and you are bagged a federal citizen.
So there's a CUSIP number attached to it.
Well, that's a Craig question. Anyways,
yeah,
anything else, Michael?
What was it I was going to say? Yeah, Mandel House, he was a real scumbag. But
thank you for your opinion.
Marijuana.
Do you have first-hand knowledge of that? Are you that old?
Just about. But
just about.
Marijuana right. was something they made up. It's not. It was either called hemp or what's the other one? Anyway, they used to sell it to England, and the English got upset when if we didn't sell it to them because they had a big business going on that. But, in you know, international law supersedes national law. And in 1961, the United States did a treaty with the United Nations that took marijuana off of the class 5 with meth and heroin and whatnot and put it way down on the crime list there. But they forgot to tell anybody about that. So from 61 on, they were putting people in prison, some of them for just having a joint for life, and they knew they were violating the law. So they're all criminals. They're all frauds.
It's all about the bennies. Thank you, Michael. Appreciate you very much. Next is George. Go ahead, George.
Yeah, two questions. One is, when you correct your status, does that cease the trading of your birth certificate? Do you basically extricate yourself from that system?
I couldn't answer that question. Yes, it, all I know.
Yes.
Go ahead.
Yes, it does. Once you're identified as not being of their property, it's no different than a vehicle. If you have produced proof that they have no legal claim to a motor vehicle, for example, an automobile, they can no longer put that automobile on their ledger side. It has to be taken off their ledger. The CUSIP number is just simply a means to track assets. If they have a rock, they can put a number on it and put it on their ledger as an asset. Now somebody's going to ask them, you know, how did you come to that value? And if they find that there's a lot of mischief going on there, for example, if you have a promissory note and you put it on a ledger, they have professionals that look at promissory notes, and they statistically can value that note over the next 30-year time period. It's just an asset on there. It's perfectly legal, in most cases, I should say. It's just the means of putting assets on their ledger. Now, if you want to be an asset on their ledger, they'll provide you means to do it by deception. But Michael's system here is taking that away by actually going in and tell them, take me off your and my cars and my house and my labor off your ledger and give me a document that says you did. And that's pretty much what correcting your status does. It's moving the property off their ledger back onto the rightful owner. That would be you.
Good. Okay.
Does that make sense?
The next question. Yep, it does. Now, if you go through your correct status and then you own a house and you go and file or whatever you have to do to not pay property tax anymore on your property, once you stop paying property taxes, does that exclude you from county services like fire and police and water and all of those kinds of things? Is anything adversely affected when you do that?
You have to look at each one individually. Yes, for example, when you stop paying property taxes, you are no longer sending funds to the fire department. So you go down to the fire department, you give them the location of your property, and you ask them how much does it cost to pay for that service. So you pay for it individually. And by law, I believe by law, they have to. They can't charge you any more than they're charging anybody else. A lot of people don't realize that in America, you can't charge. If you have a company that orders 50 million tons of cement a month, they can't charge somebody else more except for delivery fees. But if you go pick it up at the dock, they can't charge you any more than the big purchaser. So you can take that to your advantage in a lot of ways in America. Now, they don't want people to know that, but they're not allowed to monopolize because of volume.
So it's sort of like a most favored nation price or clause or whatever. So then what about police? Is it the same thing there?
I don't see police is probably it's probably quasi-private. I don't know. I haven't quite figured it out myself. I don't know how the police are funded, actually. I've never been able to quite figure that out. If you look at your property taxes, vast majority of it's going to the school. And then a little bit goes to your fire, and there's not a whole lot of other columns on there. I don't understand how the police get funded. And they say that when you pay a ticket, it goes to the school, and at least when I was younger, that's what they were telling me. Now, that's probably not true. They're probably funding the police with that ticket. It's kind of like a charity drive. You know, we fund the school with this charity drive, but you find out that 99% of it goes to the fundraisers.
Sure, exactly. And one last thing, PJ, is when you say, like, currently, if you don't correct your status, you go and you write a letter to the IRS saying, prove to me that I owe tax. What is it that makes it that they can't say that you owe tax? Is it because the 16th Amendment was never ratified? Or, you know, what's the basis behind?
George?
Yeah.
It's called the Internal Revenue Service. It's not called the National Revenue Service. It's the Internal Revenue Service. It's internal to Article 1, Section 8, Clause 17. So when you offer your status paperwork from your correcting your status, you simply mm-hmm. ask them, I'm confused. This is my citizenship status. How does your efforts to collect money from me apply to this status? See what happens. This is all new to us. They have been working this. The information provider, GW, that is on the Monday call. And everybody on this call here, you absolutely need to be on the Monday call because you're going to learn now on that call. That specifically goes to correcting your status. You're going to learn that that his 13 years that he's been doing this, he's had 100% success with traffic. That's basically what he's been doing it for. Other people have gone down other paths with regards to the IRS and other applications, but this fellow here has been doing it strictly on traffic to speak of. And I'm handing, or GW is handing this tool to people like PJ and other members of the team saying, well, you know, you're correcting your status. You're not changing your status. Changing your status implies that it was this before and that was okay but it's not okay today, so we're going to change it. No, you're correcting your status. Ab initio, correcting your status from the point of the beginning, i.e. your birth certificate. And you want them to correct their records nunc pro tunc from the beginning. You want them to correct their records and change them because they made them when they did this. Well, if that's the case, if 30 years ago, say you're 60 today and 35 years ago you got caught with a kilo of cocaine or something, and, you know, you spent 13 years in prison or however long you spent, that's a void judgment because you weren't someone subject to that jurisdiction at that time under those laws. It's a void judgment. And of course, we all like Richard Cornforth and his great studies and investigations into void judgment. So that's where we're taking this. And then furthermore, when I have 100 or 200 people that have gone through this process, I'm going to ask them if they would consider volunteering to be on a grand jury, internet-based grand jury. We have that right under the Seventh Amendment of our federal constitution to organize a grand jury, indict some people, invite them to be tried, have petit juries to try them, trial by jury, not trial by judge, trial by jury. The judge is just a referee, and, you know, do what we do. And then possibly request to enter foreign judgments into the United States list of judgments. Wouldn't that be? This is mind blowing. This is absolutely mind blowing. Anything else, George?
No, that's it. Thank you.
Thank you. Tom is next, followed by Nita, followed by Michael, and followed by Craig. Hey, we're going to look forward to that one. Go ahead, Tom. Tom, your turn.
Hi, Michael. How are you doing?
Hello, Tom.
Okay, can you hear me now?
All right. Hear you just fine. Thank you.
I had to dig some papers out. Is it Greg, the gentleman that was talking, got me wound up here? We're from the same school here. First of all, Michael was talking about something about smoking a joint and getting put in prison. Well, most people that are in prison have a joint. Got a little humor there?
They're in the joint. Yeah, I know. Very good.
Full-time joint.
They're in the joint, yeah.
Gray Bar, okay. Hotel, any other names you want to?
Yeah, oh, I sure do. I appreciate the other gentleman talking. I went and pulled my papers while we were talking. That's why I'm a little bit disorganized here right now. But I did file the instrument in my federal case. I had the CUSIP number. I was doing very well. I was mentored by Robert Fox and Tony Davis, along with Merlin. I'm from the old school. And I have filed for the, what did I file in? I appointed a fiduciary debtor, and then I accepted my birth certificate, and I did numerous, numerous things and was making some progress. And then all of a sudden, bang, the public pretender and the prosecutor started using the words that I was anti-government, and I don't want to use the other word that they call us as some kind of a, you know, like a domestic cat, but it's worse than that. And things just completely, completely went sideways, and they completely tainted the jury, and it took the jury about a half an hour to find me guilty. But I was excited when this gentleman came on, because I have numerous papers somewhere filed along that, so I would like to speak with him and see how we can resurrect this, because I still feel there's remedy, and the people that RICO'd and conspired against me knew they were doing wrong, but I was in there all by myself, you know. So I thank
sure.
you,
Tom. Why don't you call me tomorrow afternoon? It needs to be afternoon because Craig's 3 hours behind me, and I'll see if I can't hook up you and Craig to talk with each other. And the thing is that Craig can give a little counsel to the team as to how that CUSIP may have some application. We'll maybe put that together. So anything else,
yeah.
Tom?
Yeah, no, that's fine. Thank you, guys. Appreciate it, and God bless you, and you're in our prayers. So thank you. Hang in there. Bye.
All right, bye-bye. Thank you. Next is Nita, followed by Michael, and then followed by Craig. Go ahead, Nita.
Gentlemen, Craig mentioned something about, well, anyway, is there any more information on what he's doing, a website, different
no.
information?
Let me just be clear, Anita. It was what's the word, serpentitious? No. Anyways, it was just a fluke that he popped up on my screen, and I reached out to him, and I popped up on his screen when he connected to the social media that I'm on. And that was it. And I haven't talked to Craig in buku years, over a decade. So. He and I are just reconnecting now. So give it a little time. Give us some time to put some things together.
Okay, no problem. The gentleman that came on there first and talking about the case that is about to be voted on.
Yes.
Could you put information on some form here that we can put together, the phone number that we're to call, and what is the law that they're voting on? Before I could get a pencil
sure.
and write this down.
Yeah, I'll be glad to.
Okay. I'd appreciate that.
Mm-hmm.
And do I understand that on the changing your status that you're going to void the judgments that are against you of the past? Is that what I heard?
If the judgments against you were part of the United States Code, yes, because you don't have any application as a citizen of one of the freely associated compact states to be subject to the United States Code. That is only for Article 1, Section 8, Clause 17, land and people.
Okay. Well, I've got it right then. So that's what I thought I was hearing. And
this longstanding friend that you have that was injured so gravely so many years ago, this is perfect for him.
Okay. What about the map that you were talking about? How would I type that in again? That was kind of quickly run by there. How would I research that on the net to find out where the federal lands are? Just type in federal land map? Is that what I would look for?
What I used, and it's in my title here, is map of all U.S. federal land. U.S. federal land. U.S. period, federal land. Map of all U.S. federal land. And
okay,
it'll
I got
take
it.
You right
That's
to
fine.
It.
Okay, got it. Okay.
All right.
Those are my questions, and We'll all be in touch. And thank you, gentlemen. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Nita. Appreciate you very much. Next is Michael, then followed by Craig, and then we'll call it an evening. Go ahead, Michael.
So I correct my status, then I file a criminal complaint against them for the CUSIP number and demand the interest on the money that they made off of merchandising me. Do I have that right?
I just unmuted Craig. So you got PJ, Craig, and Michael. Go ahead. Go at it. Talk about it.
I don't think they're not merchandising you. They're merchandising the average income that is derived from an individual in such a situation. Now, if they fraudulently have you on their tax rolls, that's not good. The person that's actually putting value on that because he doesn't have all the information, he's going to possibly get burned on the end. But I don't believe it's on you. It's on like a promissory note. It's on the average revenue that's going to come in off that promissory note for the next 30 years. That's the tracking number. That's what it's associated with. So just like a prepaid insurance policy, it's on your books each month in a little bit different number, and it's spread out.
Can I butt in here for a second?
Yeah, go ahead.
Please do.
Yeah, so here's the thing. My mantra is this. If it's not simple, I don't want anything to do with it. This is how simple this whole thing is with the CUSIP number. Once you get your case number or your loan number or your driver's license number or your birth certificate number or any number of any, credit applications, I mean, you name it, they CUSIP it. Okay, so what they're doing is when you get a report back, it shows that a security was formed, and the only name on the security is yours, okay? So they've stolen your identity, first of all. Well, first they conspired to steal your identity. Then they did it. Then they created a security, or they conspired to do a security. Then they did it. And then it's money laundering. I mean, this is the biggest crime in the history of mankind. It's unbelievable. When people, at my family home a couple of weeks ago, and I was talking to a couple of attorneys about this, and they said, oh, that's ridiculous, Craig. And I pulled out my computer and I showed them. I said, look, this is what's happening. I said, we can't get evidence right away. What we can get is information. And it leads to evidence because if you get involved in a case, that's when you unlock the discovery. And once you can get discovery and you start asking the fund manager all these uncomfortable questions as to where this thing came from and who's the beneficiary, because it sure as hell isn't you. So the guy that's asking about, can you claim the interest on these bonds that they created? Probably. I've heard people have done it. I haven't seen it done myself yet. But all I know is this, when we go into court and we show them that we have this information, it's not yet evidence, it's just information, they do not want to talk about it, and they will dismiss this case and they'll get rid of it one way or the other. And there's even a law that says that they can't even talk about it. And if they do, they could go to jail for 20 years. It's monumental. And it's when people realize, when I first learned about the CUSIP, I thought, there's got to be more to it than what I know. And as I learned over the last 5 years or so, it's amazing. I mean, it really is. And once you start talking about it, they will not talk about it. They will figure out a way to dismiss the case or get rid of it or settle it or do something. But they don't want this on the public record. I guarantee you.
Have you dismissed 20 or 50 or 100 cases, you believe, by this process? I'm just curious.
No, only about 7 or 8 cases, but that's enough to show And actually, it's probably a little more than that, because I gave information to some people and they did it themselves, and they came out with the same result. Because the thing is that and it's not my process, you know. It's like I'm just a guy that knows some stuff and that's pissed off enough to be able to do this kind of stuff, you know, because you have to be. You know, a normal Joe Sixpack, you know, who's, you know, watching the football game isn't going to turn his head for this. He's not going to believe any of this stuff, because it just sounds too crazy, you know. But as people on this call know, this whole system is so crazy. And, you know, it's like most of the people on this call probably didn't get vaccinated, you know. So I know.
Yeah. A lot of times, judges will just back off. Prosecutors and judges will back off just because, you know, they just don't want to go down that dark alley. They just don't exactly know exactly what's going to happen. So they just
When I go to court with somebody, this is what we tell them. This is what we tell the DA before we go into the courtroom. We say, Mr. DA, here's my friend John. John's put this stuff in, as you know. I know you guys can't talk about it. I know that, and so what? So John's not really well-versed in law, but I am. And so if I find you people doing anything wrong, I'm coming after you. Now you're going to have me to deal with. And see, they know me in the San Francisco Bay Area. They know me in like 9 counties, and they don't like me at all. And so they always know when I come into one of their courtrooms, they're going to have a rough day. And so, and they never know who it's coming from. And every once in a while, I'll just go into one of their courtrooms just for fun, just to terrorize them and let them think that I'm with somebody. And then they got to walk on eggshells, because they know that I'll file complaints when I find them breaking the rules. You know, I don't have to be a defendant to complain. So, and they know that, you know, it's my hobby. It's what I do. It's what I like to do.
You brought up old memories about complaints.
Well, it was that Central Lady case that got us kicked off with this kind of stuff. You remember that?
The tattoo parlor guy?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That was absolutely hilarious. I mean,
Craig, wait a minute. Let me set this up real quick. We're going beyond the time, and I apologize to PJ, because it's usually just an hour, and we're already hour 40 in it. But this, you got to hear this story. Here's a tattoo parlor guy, okay? So we're not talking, and I'm not being derogatory to tattooers and people like that, but I'm just saying that the guy was rough around the edges. Let's just say that. And
he showed up in court in a tank top and cutoffs and flip flops.
Okay.
Yeah.
So he's got this location in a very desirable commercial area of town. Very desirable. And here he is operating his tattoo business. So just to paint that picture of him. So what happened? How did he get in trouble? Why did he get in trouble? And what did he do about it?
So I was on a conference call one day, and I heard about this guy in San Mateo, who was a tattoo parlor owner. They wanted to get rid of him. They didn't like him. They wanted to run him out of the neighborhood because he wasn't cooperating with the county and all this kind of stuff. And so anyway, he was asking, is there anybody around here who could come to court with me? And I said, well, you know, I'm 75 miles away, but I guess I could do it. And so for the next year, I went to court with this guy once a month, at least maybe sometimes twice in a couple of months. But so the first time, what happened was they charged him with drunk in public, which he wasn't, interfering with a cop in the performance of his duty, and there was one other charge. I just can't think of it off the top of my head right now. But anyway, so what happened was his girlfriend was Chinese, and she was driving, and they pulled her over. And they accused her of drunk driving. Well, she doesn't drink, and, you know, she's basically driving while Chinese, which is really bad drivers. I don't know if anybody's ever been around them, but they're
not the greatest drivers in the world. Anyway, so
let's tighten this up, Craig.
So Al interfered. He told the cop, "Hey, she doesn't even drink." Well, they smelled beer on his breath and said, "Oh, but you do, and so we're going to arrest you." So anyway, we go to court. I go to court in the second hearing. He had the first hearing, and at the first hearing, she ordered him to go to a couple of doctors. Well, he did, and so in the second hearing, the one that I went to, she said, "I'm in receipt of this the communication from these doctors that said that you didn't go and see him," and he said, "Yeah, he did." But she, because we had the record from the first hearing, and we could prove that she sent him to the two wrong doctors or the two different doctors. And she was confusing herself with somebody else. So anyway, they threw him in jail because when she said, "I'm in receipt of this information that you didn't see these doctors," he said, "Yeah, well, I'm in receipt of information that you don't have a proper oath of office." And she said, "Okay." And they had six deputies in the courtroom just for him. And they grabbed him and they took him away. Well, we had in a Whole Foods bag a tape recorder with a microphone sitting on the bar. And the cops came and snatched that up, and so before I left the courthouse, a deputy found me, and they gave me the bag, and sure enough, the tape hadn't been tampered with. We sent it to a transcriber who transcribed it. We sent a copy to Merlin. Merlin wrote up in a couple of days an FBI complaint, a petition to impanel a grand jury, and an order for recusal, and so we go back to court the next month, and the judge, and it was hilarious. We walked in the courtroom, and it was packed. They were getting ready to choose a jury, and we were the first case and the last case they were going to do before the jury. And so they had all these prospective jurors in there. And when we walked in the door, I noticed there was a gaggle of attorneys talking to the bailiff, and they all turned to look at us when we sat down. And I said to the guy next to me that was sitting there, I said, "Hey, you know what they were talking about?" He goes, "Well, sounds like they're talking about a couple of guys that charged a judge with kidnapping." I said, "Yeah, that's us." Anyway, so when they called this case, they went into chambers and they discussed how they were going to play this Tennessee two-step. And so they came back out and the judge admitted that she violated his rights. And she, I couldn't believe it. She said, "Well, somebody absolutely knows about civil procedure and this blah, blah, blah. And I'm going to recuse myself." And so that started a year's worth of going to court and recusing every judge in that courthouse until we got to the presiding judge, who finally said to the prosecutor came in, and the judge says to the prosecutor, he's waving this like telephone book, like New York City telephone book thick file at her, and he's saying, "Inside this file, there's very serious charges about kidnapping and kidnapping for ransom, false arrest, false imprisonment, theft, extortion." He says, "I want you to go back to your office and treat this like you're a law student, and you're going to make a straight A on this one and come back here in 2 weeks and tell me what's going on with this." And so 2 days later, we get a phone call saying, "We're going to dismiss all the charges." You know, so that's the thing is that we never gave up. And every judge we went up against, we pulled their oath of office. They didn't have a proper oath. It's the same thing today. No, there's no California judge. I've looked up over 500 judges in California now, and there's not one judge that's got an oath of office that's proper. Not one. And all the politicians. And so right now I'm involved with a case where it's a guy running for Congress, and he tried to file his paperwork properly with the election commission, and they wouldn't accept it because it was a full oath. And so it's going to be hilarious. We're going to see what happens on the 30th, which I guess is tomorrow. There's a hearing, and it's a Zoom hearing, so I'm going to watch it on Zoom, and we'll see what happens if they uphold the law or not. But, and we Q-sipped that case just in case he needed some leverage, you know, because I'm telling you, When you utilize the information properly, you have a lot of power. It gives you a lot of power that you never knew you had. I've given this to a number of people, and they look at it and go, "So what? Well, did you read anything about it? Did you read any of the stuff that I sent you?" Well, no. Well, then you don't have a clue as to what you're doing, and then you shouldn't do it. You should just go plead guilty And, you know, so that's the thing. You know, it's like the people here, they want, Americans want, or they're not Americans, they're U.S. citizens. U.S. citizens want everything handed to them, and they don't want to work for it. And, you know, it's like I'm sick of them.
Craig, I have a quick question, Craig. Does the QCIP number have anything favorable for a homeowner facing foreclosure?
Absolutely. You take that.
How?
This is what I would do if I was facing foreclosure. I would open a bankruptcy. I would QCIP the loan number. Because what you'll find on the QCIP report is the name of the person that did the loan is the only name on that document. And it's not for that person's benefit, but I would just list that as an asset. It's got your name on it. It looks like it's mine. It can't be Michael Edwards. It doesn't say Michael Edwards. Wow. That's Craig Patterson. And I would list that as an asset and go into that bankruptcy court and have the judge tell that attorney for the bank, you better go settle this asshole. Don't bring this kind of shit in here again. You know, because it threatens the very foundation of the system. That's what you've got.
Wow.
If you know how to utilize it properly. You know, so anyway, yeah, if you want to talk tomorrow or something, I haven't eaten all day and I got to go get something to eat. But the thing is, and what I always tell people is I do everything simply. The paperwork that we will do is like 2 pages at the most. It doesn't have to be long.
You've done my heart well. It's just terrific to be chatting with you again. And PJ, thank you so much for allowing us to borrow some of your time tonight as well. If there's anything else, we want to say goodnight. Michael, you want to close with anything?
Right. Am I on?
You're on. Yeah, I never took you off.
I'll volunteer for the jury, and you can deputize me to go bring them in. I'm a union iron worker, and I don't care.
The phrase, quote, with extreme prejudice, end quote, mean anything to you, Michael?
I'm not prejudiced against anybody. Without prejudice, all rights reserved.
Okay, thank you. Good night, everybody.
Michael, if U.S. Marshals have authority to make arrests, the sovereign people of America certainly have that even more so authority. Go ahead, Michael.
Absolutely. Yeah. Thank you all for joining us this evening. Again, to remind you, the Saturday call is to learn how to own nothing, but control everything. Think of Tom Selleck as Magnum P.I. when that comes around. Monday is the call with regards to correcting your status. In fact, go to www.correctmystatus.com. It is it'll redirect you to AmericanByBirth.com, and that is an ugly looking website. I know that. I never finished it, but it's there with some information. The phone number and the PIN number for tonight's call with PJ is the same as it is Saturday with Bernie and the same as it is Monday with GW. So until then, good night, everybody. Thank you for joining us, and be well.
The conference is now completed. Goodbye. Welcome to the conference. Please enter the conference ID followed by the pound key. Thank you. Guest ID accepted.
Thank you.